Perhaps I should make a start because I really can't afford to fall behind today because it's my last one. So this projector is threatening to self-destruct in a couple of minutes, so I'm rather hoping this one won't. So if it, we'll see. I have to wait long. So carrying on from last time, I told you about Turing machines, and we met the idea of the Church Turing thesis, which is the idea that anything at all that's intuitively kind of computable in a mechanical way, whatever that means, is in principle computable on a Turing machine. So Turing machines have some theoretical interest in that they appear to capture something about the limits of what can be done by what we would recognize as mechanical computation. So if you can prove some results saying no Turing machine can do such and such, that's kind of interesting, because if you believe this Church Turing thesis, that suggests that no kind of mechanical algorithm or computation procedure, whatever, can do such and such. So today we're going to look at some things that you can show can't be done by Turing machines, and hence perhaps can't be done by any kind of mechanical computation that we know of. Right, oh yes, so this is just a sort of a curtain raiser, if you like. So this is not exactly what I'm going to talk about, but this is more a kind of prelude, just to kind of plant a certain thought in the back of your mind, and we'll come back to it later. So it's rather, ah, good. Okay, so you may, we've just lost the projector on this side, so you may prefer to sit at least not at the extreme that side. So we've got this projector there. Okay, so this is a teaser known, which is called Russell's paradox, which is very important in the history of mathematical logic. So suppose we try to define a set R, and we define it to be the set of all sets that aren't members of themselves, okay? So in theory, I mean, a set's a sort of collection of things. So in theory, you might be able to imagine a set, one of whose members is the set itself. Supposing, gosh, I'm not used to doing it this way around. Supposing you consider all sets such that sets S such that S isn't a member of S, and you call the set of all those things R. This is the idea. And then you ask, does R contain itself? In other words, is R a member of R? Okay. Now, because of the way R is defined, R is a member of R if and only if R is a set S with the property that it's not a member of itself. So if you try saying R is a member of R, that means that R isn't a member of R. On the other hand, if R isn't a member of R, then it jolly well is a member of R, because that's the definition of R. Okay, so that's sort of a paradox. So that kind of worried people, and there's a long story about what you do about things like this, how you kind of resolve this as a sort of issue in the foundations of mathematics. I'm not going to talk about that today, but the little analogy that Russell himself used to explain this is, suppose we're told that the village barber shaves exactly those men in the village who don't shave themselves, right? Shaves all the men who don't shave themselves. And then you ask, does the village barber shave himself or doesn't he? Okay, so he does, if you think about it, you see he does shave himself if and only if he doesn't shave himself. So that's, well, it's a kind of a paradox, okay? So I'm just going to leave that to one side. That's just to sort of plant an idea in the back of your minds, which is going to, which we'll see coming up in a different form later on in the lecture. Okay, so let's get back to Turing machines. Let's suppose we're talking about Turing machines, and we've got an input alphabet, let's say, with at least two elements. Okay. So, if you like, supposing our input alphabet contains at least the symbols 0 and 1, so we can write stuff in binary, okay? Now, you all know that all the kind of data that computers normally deal with, you know, whatever file type, you know, text files, kind of images, loads and loads of things, are all ultimately written in terms of zeros and ones in binary, okay? So, it's not too hard to swallow the idea that any kind of finite data at all can in principle be coded up as a string over this alphabet sigma, if you can, if you've got enough to do binary, then you've got enough to do anything. So you can write natural numbers, you can write all sorts of any kinds of finite structure that you want. Okay, and hence you can write it on a Turing machine tape. Okay, so and now according to the Church-Turing thesis, any sort of mechanical computation that you can perform on any kind of finite data can in principle be performed by a Turing machine once you've encoded stuff up as strings of sigma star, okay? And what's more, any decent programming language that's worthy of the name of a general purpose programming language has exactly the same computational power in principle as a Turing machine. So not only can anything you can do in any other language be done in principle on a Turing machine, but any language that's sort of got any decent amount of computational power at all will let you do everything that you can do on a Turing machine. So for example, I cunningly chose the language Micro Haskell in the assignment. Although it's quite a small language, I cunningly chose it so that in principle it's Turing complete. So any function, for instance, from integers to integers that you can compute on a Turing machine, or indeed any other language at all, can in principle be done by a program in Micro Haskell. Okay. So although it might be a lot more convenient to work in a bigger language, okay, in principle you've got all the power there in principle. So we've got this class of Turing computable functions, and they're the ones computable on Turing machines, and they're the ones computable in any other language you care to think of. Once you kind of abstract away from limitations on the amount of memory you've got available and the amount of time. So you assume you've got unbounded amounts of time and memory at your disposal. But given that, we've got the power of Turing machines here. Okay. So here's a particular thing you can do with a suitable Turing machine. So let's think about Turing machines with an input alphabet sigma. Okay. Now, to specify a Turing machine, right, you only need to give a certain finite amount of information, because you need to say like how many states you've got and how many symbols in your tape alphabet you've got, and you've got to say what the transition relation is, so what you do for each combination of states and symbols. So you can imagine listing the transition table for a Turing machine. It's just a kind of finite bunch of stuff, right? Okay. Any amount of any Turing machine is something you can finitely describe. Okay. So it'd be easy enough to think of a way of coding up descriptions of Turing machines themselves as strings over the alphabet sigma, okay? Assuming sigma has at least got two symbols in it, like 0 and 1. You can code anything, any finite bit of information you like in terms of sigma. So let me write T bar for some string which kind of codes up or represents a complete description of the Turing machine T, okay? I'm not going to go into details of how you might do that, because it really doesn't matter how you might do that. Any reasonable scheme that you would be likely to devise for coding up Turing machines as strings would be okay. But the point is, you just need to catalog a certain amount of finite amount of information, and you can do that. So you can imagine there being a universal Turing machine, which I'll call U, with the following property. So U takes as its input a piece of chalk. Okay. So imagine on the input tape for U, so we've got U here and it's staring at a thing. On the input tape for U, let's say we've got some stuff here which is a description, well, I'll write it like this. Some stuff here which is a description of another Turing machine T. And then we've got a blank symbol just as a separator. And then we've got some stuff here, which is an input string S. And so we've got blanks either side of it. So U takes as its input a description of a Turing machine T and a possible input string S. And what U does is it simulates the execution of machine T when applied to the input string S. Okay? So I've got all this memory for it to play around with. So U will look at T and ask what will T do on the input string S, and it will kind of step through the computation of T. So notice that a single step of a computation of T might require lots of steps of U to simulate it, but In principle, that's what it does. So if T ever, so we're simulating one Turing machine with another. We're simulating T with U. So if T ever halts on this initial input string S, in other words, if T ever enters its final state, and let's say U will notice that T has entered a final state, and U will itself go into a final state and then halt. On the other hand, if the computation of T runs on forever, then the simulation of it by U will just run on forever, okay? So U will halt if and only if T halts, okay? I've said we can imagine such a universal Turing machine, U. If you believe the Church-Turing thesis, that anything you can do by a sort of mechanical procedure you can do on a Turing machine, then you can believe this, right? Because the problem of simulating the behavior of a Turing machine is certainly something you can do mechanically just by following rules. So there ought to be a Turing machine U that does it. But even if you don't want to buy into this philosophical claim of the Church-Turing thesis, we can in any case construct one explicitly. So there can be a Turing machine U with, I don't know, about 30 states, something like that. It's possible to define, build a Turing machine that can simulate any other Turing machine with the same input alphabet. And that's why we call U a universal Turing machine, because U can do, in principle, do anything that any other Turing machine can do. So we can think of U, if you like, as a computer that runs software, okay? So whereas a Turing machine T itself might be thought of as a bit of hardware, a mere description of T as data on a Turing machine tape, okay, can be thought of as software. So we've got this universal Turing machine U, and we're programming it by writing a series of data there which tells us what machine we want to try and simulate, and then we give the input for that machine, and U will do it for us. Okay. So I want to emphasize that this is in some sense an absolutely fundamental concept. And in terms of the history of computing, this was in some ways the central idea that led to the discovery or the development of general purpose programmable computers. So this fundamental insight that you can have just a single machine that can do all the jobs you might want it to do, can simulate all the mechanical computation procedures you could ever hope for, just by feeding it with the right numbers, okay? That was this idea that Turing came up with in his concept of the universal Turing machine, okay? And that's what means we can have like a single machine, a single physical device here, or down here, or wherever it actually is. And think about all the different things that that machine can do. You know, you can play games on it. You can think of a long list of different things you can do on computers. So, I mean, it completely contrasts with what you would find. I mean, if you wander into your kitchen in your flat, okay, you've got one machine for cooking things, one machine for washing clothes, you've got a toaster, you've got a fridge, you've got different machines for different jobs, okay? So although we're very used to the idea, it really is quite remarkable, I think, when you stop to think about it, that you can have a single machine that can do all these different things just by feeding them with a sort of cunning sequence of zeros and ones. So that's the concept of the universal computing machine, and that's really what led to the development of a general purpose programmable computer. One machine for all these different jobs. So it's historically, it's hard to overestimate its importance. Okay, so we've got this universal machine that can sort of simulate any other machine. So in effect, you can regard this as a recognizer for the set. So here I've written sort of the encoding of a machine T, followed by a blank symbol, followed by an input string S. Okay, so that's the kind of input we give to our universal machine. So the set of T together with S, such that T halts on the input S, what I mean by that is that the computation of T when you start it off with an input S will eventually enter the final state and then stop. Okay, so this U is going to enter its final state and stop precisely when T itself eventually reaches a final state on the input string S. So the, if you like, the language that this universal machine recognizes is the set of all strings here such that T halts on input S. Right, but now let's ask ourselves, is there a machine here that recognizes kind of the other thing, that recognizes the set of pairs T and S such that T doesn't halt on the input S, okay? So we want a machine U which halts exactly if T doesn't halt when you give it S. Okay. Now, if there were, then we'd have one machine that recognizes halting and another machine that recognizes non-halting. So given any T and S, you could sort of set off U running with T and S, and in parallel with that, set off V running with T and S, and it would be guaranteed that one or other of those computations would eventually halt, would eventually terminate. And depending on whether it was U or V that terminated, you'd then have a definitive yes-no answer to the question whether whether T halted on input S. So you would have solved the halting problem. So you would have got a way of deciding yes or no, does a given T halt on a given input S? And conversely, if you had a machine that solved the halting problem, it always gave you a yes-no answer. Well, you could say, well, if the answer is yes, then let's say the machine halts and goes it. No. If the answer, let's say yes, if you had a machine that always gives you a yes-no answer, you could make a machine that, if that machine says no, that enters its final state and then stops. But if it says yes, then it just goes off into some completely pointless loop just to stop itself ever from doing anything. And then you'd have a machine V that met this specification. So the existence of a machine V like this is basically equivalent to the question of whether we can answer the halting problem, yes or no, by some mechanical procedure. Okay. But the theorem is, there's no such Turing machine. There's no Turing machine V with this property. You can't design a machine that's an acceptor for the non-halting Turing machines and inputs. So the halting problem, the problem of deciding whether a given computation halts or not, terminates or not, is actually undecidable. So I'm going to prove this to you. It's not actually that hard. So why is the halting problem undecidable? So supposing there were such a machine V, okay? So V, remember, V halts if and only when V halts when given T and S, if and only if T doesn't halt when given S, okay? So if V existed, then you could make a related machine W that recognized the set of strings S such that when you apply the machine coded by S to the input S, so we've got S in both places here, that doesn't halt, that runs forever. So the idea here is that what W could do is you give W a string S, and then it would just write the same string twice, okay, once in this position and once in that position. So we're using the same string both as a description of a Turing machine and as a description of its initial input. Okay, so if there were a machine W, you could make a machine which takes a string S, just copies it with a blank symbol in between, and thereover goes and does what V does. Okay, and then that would halt precisely on this set that where set of S such that S doesn't halt on input S. Okay. And now this is the trick. Okay. So now we look at this machine W that we supposedly have, and we encode this W itself, okay, as a string little w. Okay. We code it as a finite bit of information. We wrap it up as itself. And then we ask, what does the machine big W do when we give it sort of a description of itself as its input? Okay. So what does big W do on the input little w? Okay. I now remember the village barber thing. It's basically the same thing. Okay. Supposing W were to accept the string little w, that is, supposing W were to halt when given the string little w. Well, by the definition of that, that would mean that little w was in this set, okay? So little w would be an example of an S such that the Turing machine coded by S ran forever on the input S. Or in other words, the Turing machine coded by little w, which is big W, runs forever on the input s, on the input little w. So if w halts on the input little w, that tells you that w doesn't halt on the input little w. And conversely, if w runs forever on the input little w, then little w is an element of this set, okay? And so because w is supposed to be an acceptor for this set, w will accept or halt on input little w, okay? So you're in a double bind. Whichever way you try, it won't work. So that's a nice contradiction, okay? So we got there by assuming that our Turing machine V existed. So what we can conclude is V can't exist after all. So going back to the last slide, there can't be a machine V, whereas there is a machine that we've got our universal machine that's an acceptor for this set. There's no machine V that's an acceptor for this complementary set, the set of all non-halting machines and inputs. Okay, so that's a fundamental limitation on what Turing machines can do, what we can do with mechanical computations. So the halting problem, as we say, is an example of an undecidable problem. Now, I'm getting on for time. We're okay. Okay, so just to sort of establish a bit more terminology related to this. Okay. So we say a set, let's say it's a set of strings over an alphabet sigma. We say a set's decidable if you can design a mechanical procedure which will always give you a yes-no answer to the question, is little s a member of the set, big S, okay? So there'll be some algorithm which you can run on a given string, and it's guaranteed that it'll always terminate and it'll say yes or no. So you'll always get a definitive answer one way or another. That's what's meant by saying a set is decidable, okay? So that's a strong condition. For example, the set of S's that represent a prime number, say in binary, that's decidable because you can test whether a number's a prime number. You can just test all its factors up to the, all possible factors up to the square root, say. And either you'll find one or you won't, and you know you've tried, you've looked far enough and you can stop. So you'll always be able to say either yes or no, okay? You'll always stop. So the lots of mathematical properties are decidable. But there's a weaker thing. We say a property is semi-decidable, and this is a more asymmetrical notion. If there's a mechanical procedure which, when the property holds, tells you that it holds, okay, so when something is a member of S, this procedure will terminate and perhaps go into a halting state and say, yeah, put up a flag and say, yes, it's a member of S. But if it's not a member of S, this procedure isn't obliged to terminate at all, to give you anything. It might just go trundling on forever. Okay? So when something has the property, you'll know that it has the property. If it doesn't have the property, you won't necessarily know that. You can wait an awful long time hoping that it'll come back and say yes. But even if you've waited a million years and it hasn't come back yet, you don't know that, you know, 5 seconds later, it might be, for all you know, it might be just about to come back and say yes. So there's an asymmetry in this notion of semi-decidable property. So the semi-decidable sets are actually just a bit more terminology. Another way of thinking about those is they coincide with what's called the recursively enumerable sets. So the word enumerable here means you can list the elements of them by some procedure that trundles on forever. So if you imagine you've got a device churning out numbers, okay, that gives you a way of semi-deciding the set, because you can, if you've got a number, you can just sort of wait and see whether this number ever gets churned out by that machine. And if it does, then you can say, yes, it's in the set. But if it's not in the set, you'll just carry on, you'll just keep on waiting, right? The thing will churn out numbers. It won't ever tell you that it's not in the set. You'll just never discover that it is in the set, okay? And so if we're talking about sets of strings here, these semi-decidable sets also coincide exactly with what I called recursively enumerable languages in the last two lectures. So these are the languages at the top level of the Chomsky hierarchy, the ones that you can define by general or unrestricted grammars. they coincide exactly with these semi-decidable sets. Okay. So we've got an example now of a set, this set which is called the halting set. So the set of all pairs T and S, such that T halts on an input S. That's an example of a semi-decidable set that isn't decidable. It's semi-decidable because if T does halt on the input S, then you will eventually find that out by trying to simulate T on S. But if T doesn't halt on S, then not only will you not find that out just by doing the simulation, but we've shown that there's no Turing machine that can solve this decision problem for the halting problem. So there's no kind of more clever thing you can do either to work out that T doesn't halt on S. That's guaranteed to work in all cases. Okay, so, Okay. Don't know what happened there. Okay, so because this halting set, okay, it's a semi-decidable set, or in other words, a recursively enumerable set. Sorry, there are rather a lot of words for the same thing here, but it's just the way they all have subtly different nuances, but it's the way it is. So this is an example. This set is actually, because this is a set of a subset of sigma star, this is, you can actually think of this as a language, okay? So this is actually a type 0 or unrestricted language. There would be a grammar at the top level of the Chomsky hierarchy that generated exactly these strings. So that's an example of a language for which the membership problem is undecidable. You can know when you're in the language, you can know that you're in the language, but if you're outside the language, there's not necessarily an infallible way of telling that you're outside the language. Okay? Right, so this is interesting because apart from what it tells us about languages and the halting problem, even from the point of view of mathematics, this tells us something that people didn't really know before, which is that there are mathematical problems which are not solvable by any mechanical procedure or algorithm whatsoever. Okay, so the fact that the mere existence of mathematical problems that are, as it were, mechanically unsolvable was itself quite a major breakthrough in logic, because certainly in the 1920s, some very clever people, David Hilbert, for instance, really did believe and hope that there could be sort of an ultimate algorithm for all of mathematics. He really did believe or hope that there could be some killer algorithm which you could kind of feed into any mathematical statement you like. And if you turn the handle long enough, okay, you'd eventually get an answer, yes, this is true, or no, this isn't true, okay? That kind of seems kind of a bit fantastical looking back now, but at the time, it wasn't at all obvious that you couldn't do that. And, you know, he believed he'd made quite a lot of progress towards finding such an algorithm, and it was only a matter of a couple more years till he would have found it. And then the work of, first of all, the work of Gödel, but then the work of Turing kind of pretty much demolished that hope by showing that there were problems, such as the halting problem, that you could never answer by purely mechanical means like this. So kind of philosophically interesting as well as from a computer science point of view. So once we have one example of an unsolvable problem, such as the halting problem, we can use that to obtain lots of other examples. Because typically if you've got some other problem X, you can show that X is an unsolvable problem if you can show that the halting problem can be reduced to the problem X. So if you have a way of sort of coding up or translating the halting problem into your problem X, then that would mean that if you had a mechanical procedure that solved X, you could use that to solve the halting problem. And because we know that we can't solve the halting problem, there can't be a mechanical procedure for solving X either. So there are lots and lots of other interesting mathematical problems you can show to be unsolvable. And I'm just going to give a few examples in the remaining slides. Okay, so first of all, in some sense, mathematics as a whole is unsolvable. or this is an undecidable beast. In the following sense, okay. So I guess you've all seen a bit of about kind of formal logical systems. So you've seen like logics with proof rules where you can deduce theorems from other theorems, and you've got rules for and or, and you start with some axioms, and you've seen things like that. Okay, so there's a variety of quite reasonable and powerful logical systems for mathematics, which are in practice sufficient for the needs of pretty much all mathematicians most of the time. So there are systems like Peano arithmetic would be a good system for number theory, or even more powerfully, a system of that kind like Zermelo-Frankel set theory. That's a kind of system which sort of, for practical purposes, covers pretty much all of present day mathematics. Most mathematicians' work kind of fits very comfortably within, could be fitted very comfortably within the framework of ZF set theory. So don't worry if you don't know what these things are. As long as you've got the idea of a formal system where reasoning can be captured by completely formal symbolic rules. Okay. So if M is any reasonable system for mathematics, okay, the set of theorems you can prove in M is semi-decidable, and hence is actually can be generated by a type 0 grammar, but it's not decidable. Okay. So remember what I said. It was last time I think, about mathematics being wild, because you could have a short mathematical theorem with a very long proof, okay? And that's the same idea as you can have a short string with a very long derivation in a type 0 grammar. So you might be able to know that it is your statement is a theorem if you happen to find a proof of it. But if there isn't a proof of it, how will you know that there isn't a proof of it? So that's what turns out to be the case. The set of any theorems provable in M is semi-decidable, but it's not decidable. Okay, and to see that it's not decidable, we see that if M's any decent system for mathematics at all, it will be at least be able to prove all true statements of the form the Turing machine T halts on the input S. Because if T halts on S, then there's some perfectly finite computation that shows that it halts. So it's a completely finitary fact. It's a fact that just involves finite checking, as it were, that T does hold on an input S. So any mathematical system M that's worth its salt will be able to prove all true statements of this form. You can make all this more precise, but I'm just trying to give you a kind of crash course in the whole of mathematical logic, just on this one slide here. So, if you had a way of deciding whether a statement was provable, you could decide whether you could just take statements like this and decide whether they were provable. If they were true, they would be provable. And if they were false, of course, they wouldn't. So if you could decide M provability, that would give you a means of solving the halting problem. And there ain't such a thing. So that shows that kind of mathematics is undecidable in some way. Okay? And an interesting corollary that you can deduce from this. This was actually proved by Gödel in 1931, so this was a few years before Turing's work. So Gödel didn't do it this way, but you can do it this way. So however strong our formal system M for mathematics is, there are mathematical statements that escape from the power of M. So in other words, however strong M is, there must be some mathematical statement P such that you can neither prove the statement that P is true in M, nor can you prove not P. In other words, nor can you prove that P is false. So however many axioms you write down for mathematics, there'll be some statements that can't be proved true or proved false on the basis of those axioms. Okay? So there's a fundamental incompleteness as well in any system for mathematics. How do we see that this is true? Well, supposing you did have some very strong set of axioms from a very strong logical system M, such that it did settle the truth or falsity of every statement P, then you could do the following. Well, if I gave you a statement P, you could search through all possible proofs in the formal system M. You start with proofs of length 1 and then look at all proofs of length 2 and proofs of length 3 and so on. So you just search through proofs of M until you find
either a proof of P or a proof of not P. That'll work if it's the case that for any P, either one of these statements is provable. Eventually, a proof of one or the other will show up. And again, and then that will give you an algorithm for deciding the provability of P in M. Because, of course, if you found a proof of P, then it's provable. But if not P is provable and M is consistent, then P won't be provable. So you would have got a mechanical procedure for deciding whether something was provable or not. And we just said there ain't such a thing. Okay. So you can get powerful and far-reaching consequences for... Sorry, yes? We don't know any bound on the size that a proof might be. But what I'm saying is, if it were true that for every statement P, either P or not P was provable, okay, then this search procedure would always be guaranteed to terminate eventually with one or the other, even if you don't know how far you have to look. Yeah, that's the idea. But the point is, there's no system M that does have this property. So in practice, for any system M that you give me, I can give you a P such that what you say will happen. You will just carry on looking forever. You'll look at longer and longer proofs, and you'll never find either a proof of P or a proof of not P. That's how it works. Okay, so in some sense, mathematics as a whole is undecidable, right? Okay, these are quite big theorems. But there are also, even if you're sort of less ambitious than that, there are also more specific problems that you might think look much easier on the face of them that also turn out to be undecidable. So something people have been interested in ever since ancient Greek times, really, things called Diophantine equations. So supposing you've got a set of a bunch of equations here involving polynomials, this one's in four variables, but however many variables you like. And these are polynomials with integer coefficients, okay? So all the numbers here are whole numbers, okay? And you're interested in, is there a solution to these equations where the x, y, z, and w are themselves integers, right? Okay? So you might think that's quite a modest problem compared to the problem of, you know, Hilbert's problem of finding a killer algorithm for the whole of mathematics. You know, you might at least hope there was an algorithm for solving this kind of problem. Well, in fact, it turns out it's in general undecidable, given a set of equations like this, whether or not they have a solution in integers. Okay, so there would be no Turing machine such that if you wrote on the tape some encoding of these equations, well, you could write. This is a language processing course, for goodness sake. You could write these equations on the Turing machine tape and get the Turing machine to parse them, or something like that. Okay, but there would be no. However you do it. There would be no Turing machine which could infallibly say either, yes, there is a solution, and the idea, by the way, here it is, or no, there's no solution in integers to that problem. Okay, so that's what might look like a rather simple and rather modest mathematical problem that's beyond the reach of mechanical computation procedures. And what I mean, sort of fundamentally beyond the reach, not we haven't devised one yet. Slightly curiously, if you ask the same question about real number solutions, so you allow x, y, z, and w to be real numbers, then it's actually decidable whether there's a solution in real numbers. So this might be counterintuitive, but there's a problem about integers that turns out to be harder than the corresponding problem about real numbers. Yeah, bit surprising. Okay, but that's a nice example of an undecidable problem. This was proved in about in the 1950s. It was an open problem for a very long time whether there was a procedure for doing this. So this was quite a big achievement when it was shown that this was undecidable.
Okay. And now we're going to become, we're going to sort of,
we're going to turn around and bite our own tail and look at some questions of decidability and undecidability from the material, subject material of this course itself. Okay. So what questions about grammars, regular or context-free grammars, for example, are decidable, and what ones turn out to be undecidable? So as a general rule of thumb, pretty much any natural question you might ask about regular languages or regular sets or DFAs or NFAs, anything in that ballpark is pretty much decidable. You can answer any question by means of some combination of the algorithms we actually looked at in the first six lectures or so. You might remember I said that there's sort of only finitely much stuff you can say about regular languages, and I pretty much said it. Well, this is kind of what I mean by this. So, for example, if you're given two DFAs and you're asked, do they define the same language or don't they? Well, you can always answer that question because you can minimize. There's a mechanical algorithm you can apply to minimize those DFAs, okay? And then you just have to look and see if they're isomorphic. And if they're isomorphic, they'll define the same language. If they're non-isomorphic, it's guaranteed they'll define different languages. So you can answer questions about any reasonable questions that you might be asked about regular languages and stuff like that can be answered by means of some mechanical procedure. That's not true for context-free languages, okay? So it's not decidable if I give you two grammars, okay, and I ask you, do those two context-free grammars define the same language? That might, in general, be a very hard problem. There's no kind of mechanical algorithm that you can apply that's guaranteed to answer that question. In fact, even if I just give you one grammar, and the question I ask you is the language defined by that grammar actually the whole of sigma star? Okay, so does this grammar generate all possible strings? Okay, even that question turns out to be undecidable. Okay, so you can't have a Turing machine such that if you write all the grammar rules on the Turing tape and let it run, it'll always tell you yes or no whether it defines the whole of, whether it generates every string or not. And another undecidable thing, just from curiosity, so if we're given two context-free grammars, you remember we said earlier on that regular languages are closed under pretty much all the set theoretic operations you care about. So regular languages are closed under intersection. The intersection of two regular languages is again a regular language. That's not a context-free. That's not true for the context-free languages. You can have two context-free languages whose intersection isn't context-free, all right? But if I give you two context-free grammars and ask you, is the intersection of those two languages context-free or is it not? Okay, that too turns out to be an undecidable problem. So that's rather nasty. But what I'm really just trying to illustrate is that this phenomenon of undecidability kind of really does crop up in many areas of mathematics, many kind of problems one might normally be interested in, and including problems from our subject itself, from language processing theory, turn out to be undecidable. Okay, so that's pretty much the end of the course, really. So I would just want to end by saying, if you've enjoyed the sort of formal languages side of the course, the side that I've been talking about, then here are some courses you might like to consider doing in third year, which one way or another follow on from it. So compiling techniques, that's a more practically oriented course, but it kind of fills in the gap of how would you actually get implementations of programming languages that run with realistic kind of efficiency. How would you translate from a high-level language like Java or Haskell or something down into a machine language. So that's a kind of rather more practically oriented course, but a jolly good course. Language semantics and implementation, that kind of picks up on a little lecture I gave on programming language semantics, so how you describe at a high level the intended behavior of programs and how then you might use such a description to at least get you started in designing an interpreter or an evaluator for the language. So that's a somewhat more theoretical course than that, but it's very much in the spirit of what I've been doing. And if the kind of thing I've been talking about in the last two or three lectures grabs you, Turing machines, Church Turing thesis, undecidability, all that kind of jazz, then there's a course on computability and intractability, which kind of picks up those themes and takes them a bit further. Okay. So Marilla will. So there is one more lecture, which is a kind of way ahead lecture, which Marilla will give on Thursday. I hope you can come to it. She did say something about bringing chocolates for anyone who takes the trouble to turn up. I'll be coming to it because I'm interested in. She's going to just enjoy herself telling you a bit about sort of where things go on the natural language side, what courses you can do, but what sort of things she's interested in researching. And so if you're interested in kind of where does this stuff go on the natural language side, I do hope you're able to come to it. So that'll be the kind of, grand finale for the course, really. But, thank you for coming. Thank you for putting up with me this long. And I'll see you. I'll say goodbye properly on Thursday. But I've really enjoyed it this year actually. So I hope you've enjoyed at least parts of it as well. And I've finished on time. Thank you.
This is basically, does it cover some mathematical logics part of... because we have a huge gap between those things you're talking about.
Right, I was realizing you didn't... It's more... I can't remember exactly what it covers, but it was certainly... It won't... There isn't a gap. I mean, it won't leave a gap.
Third year?
That's a third year. These are all third year courses, yeah.
Another question. You were speaking about this term of incompleteness and halting problem. And what is the relationship between those two things? They basically seem quite the same thing.
At some level, it's the same phenomenon. So... the halting, the undecidability stuff, that's about what you can do by mechanical computation means. The Gödel theorem stuff sort of says that even if you allow kind of creative thought, in discovering proofs and finding things, even if you don't restrict yourself to applying a mechanical algorithm, if you allow creative thought, there are still going to be some theorems that lie outside the reach of any...
Basically, they together restrict humans.
You can have quite a lot of fun arguing philosophically about what they do and don't imply, but they seem to be saying something pretty deep about the limits of .
In that case, how did Andrew Wiles decided to spend 7 or 8
years in practice people still so there was no guarantee. I mean, it wasn't guaranteed for him in advance. There was no, he didn't have any guarantee in advance that there would be a proof using
just intuition.
I mean, in practice it's very, I mean, the sorts of theorems that people have found that can't be proved, say can't be settled within Peano arithmetic, they're pretty abstruse, they're pretty strange examples really, and they're not really, it would be very surprising if someone found an example from kind of ordinary number theory. You would bet that any kind of natural simple statement of number theory did have a proof or disproof, but you don't know for sure until you've found one. It would have been very, very, very surprising if you take some result of number theory that no one knows the answer to still, like the Goldbach conjecture or something like that. Okay, so that Goldbach conjecture says every even number greater than 2 is the sum of 2 prime numbers.
Okay, so
no one's proved that today. Okay, so for all anyone knows, that might be
unresolvable in current mathematical systems. But no one expects that. Okay, everyone expects that there is a proof. We just haven't found it yet.
Just can I ask one
yeah.
thing? There was this counter-diagonalization
yes.
argument.
Yeah.
Was this related to
yeah,
this?
Yeah, it's the same. At bottom, it's the same kind of trick as the Russell's paradox and the halting problem argument. It's a diagonal. Yeah, the fact that you've got this.
Yeah, I know. I was just wondering whether I'm.
No, you're right to make that connection. Okay. It's at some deep level. It's the same idea. Hi.
One very quick question. Do you know if the answers to the sort of last three tutorial sheets are going to?
Oh, that's a good. That's a good question. Yeah. I would expect they would be on the grounds that. But I can chase them up certainly.
Okay, that'd be great. Just revision, maybe.
That is a good question. That's.
Is that your?
Sorry, that's not mine. No, that was there before I.
How's that?
The
group.